And it's high noon out in Los Angeles right now, you know, on the left coast. The light is terrible. And so that means our guest today has a little bit of time he can spend with us. He's going to take a little bit of time from his busy shooting schedule. So our guest today is Daniel Sawyer Schaefer from Los Angeles.
Pleasure being here.
Yeah, well, thanks, Daniel. I'm glad you could make it today. I caught Daniel on a podcast a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to include that in the show notes because you really have to listen to it. Very good. So when I heard him, I thought, and I saw his work, I said, this is a guy we have to get on the show here. So Daniel, welcome.
I feel very welcome. Thank you, Bob.
Oh, good. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you come from, what brought you to where you are today, how you got into photography, all those kind of things.
All right. Well, I was born and raised Los Angeles, California, kind of bouncing around Studio City, Van Nuys, Hollywood. I always had some aspect of that in my life, but also spent a lot of time growing up in New York City. My mom is from back east. My dad's from out here. So we kind of would split in time. And like if we ever had family things, we'd go back to New York, but then we'd come back here just for general schooling and stuff like that. So I had a nice balance of kind of growing up out here in Los Angeles and kind of the flavor of this city, but then also kind of the attitudes and effects that New York can have on a kid. So it was a good balance of the two. I'm very happy that I was able to spend that kind of time. I come from a creative family. Both of my parents are television writers. My father specifically, though, his whole life has been a photographer. Before attending USC Film School, he was a darkroom tech. He was a photographer for his school, for a couple of local papers and such, growing up in Downey. We've had Nikon photo gear sitting around the house as long as I can remember. My uncle as well, my uncle Frank, is also a photographer and a photographer's assistant. He mainly assists Mary Ellen Mark. That's kind of the most notable client that he has. So we've always had a family that was very photo aware and photo conscious. So I've had cameras around me since I was a little kid. But I only really seriously picked one up about halfway through the 11th grade. I was actually a theater major initially, and the director asked if someone could come and just take pictures of the whole cast to put up in the hallway for one of the performances. And I said, I'm pretty sure my dad has some camera gear I could borrow. So I brought that one day, shot around, took the portraits I needed to, but then just kept taking pictures of the kids in my high school and the people in the neighborhoods around it and on the bus home. And I liked it. And I liked this kind of documentation. The next day, I left the camera at home and it started to drive me nuts. I was seeing all these images and seeing all these moments that I wish I could have captured. And then I get to school and everyone's like, where's the camera? And so from that day forward, I have literally not left the house without a camera around my neck since.
You're the guy with the camera.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know that guy. Oh, go ahead. Don't let me interrupt you.
Oh, well, yeah. So, from that point, I've been carrying a camera literally every day, no matter what the circumstance. Started especially just documenting the kids at my school and the sort of characters there. But then past that, started kind of initially just doing street photography before I even really knew what it was called. I wasn't really aware of the history yet. I wasn't really aware of the implications of being a street photographer. But I was going to school in Van Nuys and doing a lot of work in Hollywood and just taking pictures of the people I encountered for years on just a Nikon D70 with a 50mm. And then after that, an FM2 with that same 50. So I was always initially used to a little bit of reach, used to kind of giving my subjects some space. But that all changed a few years later when I started attending Parsons in New York City. And within a week of being there, I had actually broken my 50mm and picked up for the first time a 24, which at the time I was using a crop chip camera, and so I had my kind of 35 equivalent, and I have never left it. The 35 has kind of become my default lens. Nowadays, actually, my default lens is a 40 for a couple of odd reasons, but I started working close. I started taking pictures of people, not quite as close as Gildan or one of those guys, but definitely like really considering the relationship between subject and space and working typically a lot closer than most of my other photographer friends were comfortable with. Like I'd go on a walk with a couple of those guys and they were always shocked when I would like walk up to someone, take their picture, start talking to them and just like completely out of the blue, like strike up a conversation with someone and start photographing them. It wasn't really kind of the purest street photographer method. And so I started to drift out of that and kind of drift more into portraiture. And then I found sort of a term that I finally thought kind of got the name right of what I was trying to do, which was documentary photography. And it was photography that told a story, photography that had a distinct purpose in its documentation and not just kind of random going around taking pictures of everything, which is up to that point what I had done. It's where I started to get into creating projects and considering things not just in the moment, but in the long term and their implications therein. Trying to think. So from that point, I started projects and I would set myself goals over the course of, say, initially a month or two. Nowadays, the projects I'm working on are anywhere from 6 months to a year. Some of the projects that I have right now, I started 2 or 3 years ago, and they won't be done for another 2 or 3 at minimum. But it's allowed me to create these sort of homes for my photography, and each one has its own kind of place. It allows me to go back to photographing either young poets or magicians or the homeless community in LA, and just kind of it gives me a place to return to if I'm ever A, in a creative hole, or B, it allows me to come back to people who have become familiar with me. It's allowed me to surpass the moment where like the pure street photo being completely candid and then the photo where there's someone, the subject is aware of the photographer. And for the most part, I've been able to surpass that point now because they've gotten so comfortable and so used to me. So I'm able to get back almost to that whole idea of I'm not even there. And they like we talk, we have the genuine conversation while I'm shooting. I'm not just some silent guy with a camera. But at the same time, the camera is no longer there. They're used to it. They don't mind it. And they realize what it can do either for them or for a community at large sometimes. So yeah, that's sort of the way that the projects have come together as of recent.
I guess I should back up a little bit because the purpose of our talk today is to talk about projects. Daniel, mm-hmm. you know, Daniel did an interview on another podcast not long ago, and it was really good. And he covered a lot of general things. So I thought, well, when we talk, we should talk about projects because he does so many of them, and so many of our readers are doing projects or they want to do projects. I think they can learn a lot from you. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And Daniel has a really broad body of work, doing some fashion work and commercial work and obviously lots of street photography. So I think this is a great thing to discuss today.
Excellent.
Speaking of getting to know people, that's pretty interesting because so many street photographers are, just passing through and taking their shots. And so how do you think that affects the work you do, getting to know some of the people and them getting to be comfortable with you?
It's allowed me a really interesting degree of access, and that's one thing. As well as it's actually allowed me doors that I didn't even expect into other potential projects. For example, when I was shooting a friend's open mic that I decided to document. She runs an open mic here in LA called Say Yes. And it's something I've been going to since before I was a photographer. Something I've been doing back when I was a theater student. So yeah, documenting this project, I met a lot of young poets, and up to that point, that's not something I ever considered myself trying. And so I tried my hand at just writing kind of this slam spoken word poetry, and I was okay at it. But what this turned into is knowing these kids who I was photographing at just this backyard open mic got me into something called Brave New Voices, which is one of the first projects that appears on my website. Brave New Voices is my longest running project as of today. Maybe Magicians may be a little bit longer, but Brave New Voices is definitely the one I've spent the most time on. Brave New Voices is a youth poetry organization. They promote youth literacy, youth activism, and really this incredible community of young, very active, very, very talented poets. Once a year, about 80 teams of 5 to 10 congregate in one location. The first 2 years I documented it was in Berkeley. The third year it was in Chicago, and this summer it's in Philadelphia. And so they meet up, and there's 3 days of kind of getting to know each other and education, actually. So like workshops on poetry with well-known poets and such, kind of giving them a chance to meet people who influence them. But then the next 2 days are competition, and very heated competition. And it's respectful, but it gets in there. And so I initially went in 2011 as a member of the Los Angeles team. But within about a round and a half, we had found ourselves out of the competition. So we were just kind of sitting there, and we had nothing to do, and we didn't know what to do. I had my camera, so I started taking pictures. And after I got a little too close to the stage one time, I was told very heatedly that I was not supposed to be there. And so instinct kicked in, and I lied through my teeth and said that I was the staff photographer. Cut to 3 years later, I am the staff photographer. So yeah, I shot with absolute 100% access, being able to get into even during the Grand Slam, which is televised, I was able to get into the pit the orchestra pit and shoot from there. I was able to get backstage. I had full 100% unadulterated access just because I made something up. About a week later, I get a call after I've posted the images on Facebook and everyone's tagged in them and they're loving it and they're having a great time. And so I get a call from this guy, Nick, who is the guy who designs the posters and someone that runs some of the social media for Brave New Voices. And he was like, "Hey, we love your work. Who the hell are you?" And so I apologized and I tried to explain. He's like, no, we got to have you back next year. And I was like, wow, that would be amazing. And so I've been going back every summer it's a 5 day, 5 days a year, sadly. I wish it was more. For this incredible competition. For the first 2 years, I shot them just with my Nikons, and I lost a whole lot of shots because of how kind of large, unwieldy, and loud they were. But this past year, I started working for Leica, working for the company, and was given the opportunity to take a Leica with me to photograph the competition. And my level of access went from absolute 100% access to 150% access. I was suddenly able to be on stage because of how quiet the system was, and I was able to shoot in much lower light and handhold to much lower shutter speeds. And I finally kind of found a tool that allowed myself to do the work that I wanted to. And that was a big obstacle for me because a lot of the projects I was planning didn't allow for something as large or unwieldy as a DSLR. And so that's what got me into kind of the use of these smaller, even vintage cameras. But yeah, so the projects have, up until that point, a lot of them were on the back burner. But the use of that system allowed me to open those up, and I've been able to start a good number of them.
Yeah, that could be an expensive habit.
That's the lucky part about working for the company. Yeah. As long as I know what I need, I can use what I will. And as long as I return it in good condition, they're pretty happy.
Oh, that's really nice. My wife and I were in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. last year, and we were walking down the street and walked right past the Leica store. And I said, okay, I want to go in there. And she goes, no, I don't want to go. It's probably a good thing because I'm sure I would have wound up buying one.
Well, I work out of Lego Store Los Angeles, so if you ever find yourself in L.A., drop me a line, come into the space. The nice thing is in Lego Store L.A., and especially all the Lego stores now, there's been this really lovely switch between just showing the cameras, and now we have books. We have a gallery space, an incredible gallery space at Lego L.A., where we show, of course, works that's been done on Legos, but a lot of really new, interesting photographers who are doing stuff that kind of doesn't fit the black and white street mold.
You're starting to do some product placement, too. I remember watching Mad Men. I'm a big Mad Men fan, and he goes, well, we've got this new client. They make these cameras.
We didn't even know about that, actually. They used that without telling us, and we were very happy. But...
Oh, wow. He goes, yeah, I've got a whole closet full of these things.
The funny thing is, of all the cameras they decided to use, they used the M2, which is the least popular, second to least popular Leica ever sold, even though I adore it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty funny. They chose the only camera they could have chose that would have been sillier was the M5.
Why is that?
Oh, no one likes that camera. It's a fantastic camera, but it's definitely the only Leica that doesn't fit the Leica mold. It's very chunky and odd looking. It looks like a tank.
Yeah, I've purposely not learned about Leicas because I know I'll want one, and that just gets me pretty expensive.
Well, the lucky thing is you can actually get into the system if you don't mind not exactly going for the name brand or going way past vintage. Like, for example, an M2 is basically all the glory of the M6 or any of the really popular ones, aside from it has a manual shutter counter. So it actually, like, you have to turn it to count what frame you're on. Hmm. And no meter, which honestly for me wasn't a problem. I love shooting with the M2. I just shoot until I feel that, oh, I'm out of film, and I rewind.
What the heck?
Yeah, you can get into an M2 for maybe $400 for the body.
Wow. And then there's the lenses.
Oh, if you go for vintage 50s, I see them go, if you don't care if they're shiny, if you don't mind if they're brassed a little bit, I've seen them go for $150 on eBay.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
You can get into the system for much less money than you'd expect.
Okay, sign me up. It's funny when you mentioned the M2. I don't want to get off track too much, but one of our guests... Paul Salmon, he was on a couple months ago, and he emailed me, and he, back in, I don't know, maybe it was the 80s, he had an M2, it was his first Leica, and he had it engraved, had his name engraved on there, and he eventually sold it, and back in December, he hears from a guy in Spain who had his camera, his name was still on it, and he thought, oh, I'm going to look this guy up. Yeah, so they touched base, guy sent him pictures of it. So it's like an old friend coming back.
Yeah, they last. They're damn near indestructible.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That today's cameras certainly aren't. Anyway, let's keep moving.
Yes, sir.
So you're talking about projects. How do you decide what project you're going to work on? I mean, there's so many things, or you can't think of anything.
Well, what it is, I a while ago started just kind of a little book. And anytime I would have an idea, I would just write it in there. And what I try to do is if I can work on a project in any kind of capacity, I do. Even if it's just very lightly working on it over time. I typically at any given time have 3 or 4 projects running. Usually there's one that's just – it comes down to like what do I have the most time to shoot? What do I have currently the most access to shoot? So like right now, for example, I'm working on one that's a little bit more visual than my other stuff. It's not quite as subject driven. It's a little bit more kind of my Gregory Crudzin homage to his work and kind of old Hollywood. I spent like my whole childhood just obsessed with like old Hollywood and old time radio and old movies. So I'm shooting using a really interesting piece of gear, a Hasselblad X-Pan, which gives you a double wide frame of 35. So this beautiful distortion-free panorama that just looks incredibly movie-like. And I've been shooting with that and just shooting these things that I kind of write up these little narratives and just single frame kind of chunks out of a movie or something.
Well, that sounds really neat. In which Hasselblad was it?
The X-Pan. It's a 35 millimeter rangefinder. It just looks like someone's like stretched out a Leica. But it shoots this super wide 35, and it's really cool.
Wow. So what made you decide to do that?
It's something that visually I found this camera a couple years ago, and just I was aware of it a couple years ago, and I was very intrigued by, for me, and I don't want to sound too much like a gearhead, but the technology is very important. Finding a camera that allows you to do the work that you want to do without interruption. The reason I initially started shooting Leica was because it was the simplest, most effective platform. I was able to do just about anything I wanted to and not really have to worry about menus or settings. And just it felt like a film camera to me. And ideally, what I do shoot is film. But sadly, it's getting harder and harder to get quality stock and more expensive to scan properly. But as I shoot, I really need to consider what's my weapon of choice? What system will suit this project best? And it's been everything from 6.7 medium format to like super crop chip, compact digital, and everything in between. It just depends on, I approach the project as, all right, here's what I want to do. What do I need to do it? And I consider from there. So for this, I found it kind of worked the other way. I found the X-Pan, and I suddenly seen this double wide frame that most people use for kind of these epic panoramas, these like beautiful kind of vacation shots. Not to cheapen them, but that's sort of what they look like. They look like the kind of thing that would be on one of those double wide postcards. And I saw it immediately as a movie frame, and I got super excited. And I initially tried to buy it off of a friend of mine. Who was selling his, but then another friend of mine poached it out from under me. So I've been kind of bitter about that ever since. And then I had the opportunity just recently. I had a Sony that I was using and wasn't really enjoying, and I had the chance to trade it, and I took it in a heartbeat. And I traded my RX1R straight across for the X-Pan and never looked back.
Wow.
So yeah, it's the conscious choice. That's something that I always come back to when people ask me about photography and projects in general, is I want to make everything in my frame a conscious choice. What lens I'm using, what focus I'm using, how motion is shown, how grain is shown. I want these all to be decisions. I don't want to be forced into corners. And sometimes using those constraints is a really good thing, but other times it gets in the way. Working within constraints definitely does make you push the creative boundaries, but at the same time, too many constraints can be damaging. I always have people come in and, like, for example, I started as a 50 millimeter shooter. I'm probably never going to own another 50 millimeter. It's not a lens that I can see with. It's not something that I can pre-visualize with, and just I can't render space the way I want to. I'm a scene guy. I'm a guy who likes to balance the subject and the scene. So for me, wide angles serve a much stronger purpose there.
So when you work a project, do you have a preconceived notion? I mean, do you have certain shots you know you want to get, or are you just, again, you're going back to constraints, or do you just put a box around it and say, I'm going to get what I get within this particular framework?
Kind of a combination. Both I will have certain things that I know, all right, I'm thinking of this project, I'm thinking of its final destination, be it a book, be it a portfolio, be it a show, be it a slideshow even. And I want to think of what I want the photos to do. That's a big thing for me now, is I don't want my photos just to kind of be there as aesthetic objects anymore. I love making beautiful work, and I'm always excited when I do. But at the same time, I want there to be something behind it. I want there to be some kind of push. And for a lot of the work I do, I like to have it give back in some way. So for the Brave New Voices project, for example, I have a very distinct plan, which is after 5 years of shooting, I'm going to produce a book. And hopefully through the channels I want to go through, produce this book and produce a show and have as much of the proceeds from the two go back into Brave New Voices because they've been so kind to me and they've given me such access. I really feel that I need to kind of give back to these people that I've been kind of intruding upon for the past few years. So I really like my photos to give back in some way. That's something that's very important to me in the way that I work. Even if it's something as simple as like I get dinner with a friend and I take their portrait in a diner, like I want them to be able to see that portrait and be very proud of it and really feel like they see themselves in it in a positive light that makes them proud to show it around. There is no better feeling nowadays to modernize myself is when someone makes my photo their Facebook default. I'm like, yes. I'm like, I've won. Even better is when they make it like their Match.com profile picture. Then I'm like, all right, I've done my job.
There you go. If they're like, going to use it for that, that's
yeah. You're using an image that I created to represent yourself in like the most stressful point possible. So like you're like trying to use, and I'm very happy. I'm like, okay, then I think I've done my job. But yeah, just trying to kind of balance that. But when I do go into a project, there are certain preconceived photos where I know, all right, I need this shot. I need this shot. I need like there's like five or six shots that I just need in order to make the project understandable. But at the same time, I'm always ready for something I didn't expect. I'm always just my hand is on the focus dial, just ready to fire, because a lot of the best images are ones that you never would have expected. Again, I keep going back to Brave New Voices because it's one of my most developed projects and also one of the only ones that I actually kind of have out there right now. But there's a shot, if you go to my website, it's relatively late in the album. Most of the shots are of people actually performing, mic in hand, on a stage, kind of the peak of emotion. But there's one shot in particular that I didn't expect, and I was shooting backstage, which I always do. I shoot the poets kind of getting ready and coming back off stage, and that kind of emotional balance of like kind of revving up to go and then just kind of releasing. But an image that I didn't expect that is now probably my favorite in the album is from one of the poets who had just done a piece on selling drugs in order to pay for college. And he stepped off stage and he was just shaking. And it was an incredibly emotional, incredibly like driven piece that really put him out there. And he was just shaking and shivering. And he walks off stage and I pause him for a moment to make sure he's okay. He continues on. And then his teammates run up and just grab him. And there's just this incredibly like powerful embrace. And I just swung up the camera and shot it. And it's, I think if I only could show one photo that really shows the love and support that this competition gives, it's this photo. And it's just this group of young kids, all different colors, all different creeds, just this tangle of arms in this embrace. It's a photo I never could have planned for.
No.
It's just something that I saw and I had the wherewithal and the equipment ready enough that I could react.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, you guys are listening to this. You really have to go to Daniel's website, Outlier Imagery. He's got just some great stuff on there. And this is excellent. So
thank you.
So let's talk about some other projects. One that caught my eye because it takes place in one of my favorite places, and that's Florence.
Ah, yes.
And you even know how to pronounce Florence in Italian, which I don't know how. Forgive me, our Italian fans. I love these photos. I was there not too long ago, unfortunately only for a day. And I see you spent a fair amount of time there.
I did.
I just love the opening shot in this gallery. A picture of a couple, looks like they're taking a photo with a camera phone, and you are up close and personal. I don't know if these people were friends of yours or not.
No, sir. I had never met those people in my life. That just comes down to, again, being ready.
Okay. So how did you do this? Was this a hip shot or were you?
This was a hip shot.
Okay.
Yeah. So the project is called Via Firenze. It's also viewable not just on my website under the project section, but also I have a Florence-specific photo blog called VetroFirenze, .tumblr.com, which is linked if you go to the Via Firenze section on my website. I was incredibly lucky end of last year to be given an opportunity to study abroad in Florence for next to nothing. I was offered a consortium scholarship through an incredible school called Saatchi, which is in the process. At the time when I went, they only offered BFA programs in photography. But just as I was leaving, they started offering their master's program, which I'm actually very, very serious about potentially going back to. It's a really incredible school. It's a phenomenal institution. And so they offered me this incredible opportunity to study abroad. And at the same time, I was also lucky enough that Leica was opening up a store in Florence. And I was able to both attend school and help out and make myself of some use to the company. And I was given this incredible opportunity. And I lived there for 4 months last year. And it was really, if you have never lived in another country for that long, if there's any way you can possibly do it, I suggest it with every fiber of my being. I was incredibly lucky to be able to do it with almost no financial burden, but it's definitely worth every penny that I paid and then some. For Via Firenze, I made kind of a very conscious decision early on, which is, and you'll notice it, I do break this rule a little bit. As you go through the album, there's a combination of both color and black and white. But the bulk of the work I did in Florence, I did differently than I had ever approached photographs before. I'm always a very selective focus guy. I've always shot much wider open than most. I'm definitely an F1.4-4 kind of guy. Very calculated about my focus, very calculated about my frame. Even if it is a very quick shot, like I'm very careful about where my frame is. Camera's always to my eye. And so during my time in Florence, while talking to one of my professors there, I decided that I was going to approach it differently. And I was going to kind of go back to the classic zone focus, black and white, kind of hip shot photography. And I was shooting with a really a small camera that sadly I had more issues with it at the time. It was not a Leica. I had more issues with it at the time than I did benefits. But I was able to do some good work on it, but I regret having that specific piece of equipment because I probably missed more than I made. And there's a lot of images that will haunt me. but anyhow,
what were you using?
I was shooting an RX1R.
Oh, okay. The one you traded for the Hasselblad.
Exactly. Yeah. And the files are beautiful, but the camera for my specific use, it just was not fast enough. And I'm a rangefinder user. And if I don't have a rangefinder, I don't exactly know what to do anymore. But yeah, so this camera put out beautiful files, but I couldn't shoot with it the way I wanted to. So that's part of why shooting from the hip became a thing, because the focusing system was so slow. If I wasn't pre-focused, I would never hit the photo. So I was stopping down anywhere between F8 and F16 and just shooting really in a way that every other street photographer I met, that's all they shoot. But I had never really done that specific approach myself. And so it really – I'm very happy with the way that the images came out in the end. I was very careful with just using the one camera the whole time. I was stuck with a 35mm lens, so I really got to learn it. And I really got to understand the way it rendered subject in space, the way that sensor rendered light. And I got it to the point where it was very, very reflexive in using it. And I was very happy with the images I made in the end. But yeah, so it was 4 months just day in, day out shooting. Again, I never leave the house without a camera. Doesn't matter what the weather, what the light is, I will go out and shoot.
You've got one of the photos in the collection is a nun. It doesn't look like you shot this wide, or stop down.
This was very early on in the project, mm-hmm. And this was me testing the limits of the camera, seeing if I could hip shoot with autofocus. And this is one of the only ones that I nailed with that technique, but I did get very lucky with this particular shot. But that even that shot is actually that's probably around f2 to f4. But there are some shots actually, if you look at, they'll have shallower depth of field. But if you look at the metadata, which I'm not sure if you actually can on my website, but they look like they have shallow depth of field, but they actually are like in the f8 to f11 range. Using a technique called shift focus, where it's basically the scale focus that all street photographers kind of know and love, but shifted back in the scale, so infinity is no longer the priority of sharpness. Hmm. So now your zone of focus is basically like 4 feet in front of you and 25 feet behind you. So it means you have to work incredibly close. There's a photo of it. I'm trying to find one that's a good example of this. My internet is slowing down a little bit. But yeah, so it's this whole idea of even in this F8 to F11 range, having that control over focus if you work close. And I tend to work close.
Yeah, did this nun happen to notice you were taking her photo?
No, that is one lovely thing about the RX1. It's incredibly quiet. That being said, if anyone asked me about that, and this is not me speaking as a Leica employee. This is just me speaking as someone who spent 4 months using the equipment. I would not suggest it really as a purchase if this is the kind of work that you want to be doing. It suited me fine for the time. I definitely missed more than I hit, and that is something that will bother me for a long, long time.
Well, it doesn't show looking at the collection.
That's what I get for shooting every single day.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, those of us observing the work, we don't know what we don't know.
No, so. And editing is important. Like I'm very selective about what I show. That's something that was instilled in me from a very young age, which was like only show your best work. So I'm very, very specific about the kind of stuff that shows up in my sphere.
Well, that brings up a question I was going to ask you is when you're getting ready to publish a project like this, how do you go about making your selections? How do you edit your work? Do you have a set process you go through?
Well, usually what I ideally like to do is I print everything. And I'm actually still a photographer who prints, I'd say, 95% of my work, especially my finals. I always print like my final selections. But recently, I've been using Lightroom, purely because of the sake of ease and sadly the cost of print. But even like my favorite way to do it is just get a big table, take a flash drive to Walgreens with my selection of I like break it down to about like 100 or so in Lightroom, and then once I need to really make my conscious decisions as to order and as to final batch, I either can do it in Lightroom, which is a really friendly program for it. I have a color key system that I really enjoy. But I'll just take my 100 or so semi-selects to Walgreens and print out some 4x6s and then go home, lay them out all on a table and do it physically. And I still find the physical kind of going through prints to be the most satisfying way to do it because it also allows me to create order. Like Lightroom will let you batch it down to whatever photos you want, but then it's kind of difficult to change the order in a way that I really like. So the actual prints will allow me to. I always think of targets as either books, shows, or slideshows. Books are my favorite thing to do. Books are portfolios. Like for Via Firenze, if anyone ever stops by Leica Los Angeles, I have a little box. That I had this box custom made for the project that holds about 20 of the black and white photos. I kept that specific final output just to black and white, even though some of my favorite photos in the series are color. But yeah, it's really doing it physically. And I miss the sort of going through prints, going through negatives. I still, every chance I get, I much prefer film to digital nine times out of ten still. And that's just, it's my aesthetic. It's my process. I don't mind not being able to look at the image immediately. And yeah, it's just sort of my approach.
When you make those final prints, how do you do it? Are you printing them yourself or are you sending them to a lab? Oh, okay.
No, I'm an Epson certified print tech. I have, my father and I have a full print setup here in the house. Epson 9880 for the large format stuff, 2880 for the smaller stuff. While I was at Parsons, I was a print and scan tech, so I got to kind of cut my teeth on the equipment there, which was far out of my budget and incredibly nice, but it taught me how to deal with just about any other system out there. So, I'm still a guy who really likes a beautiful final print. I'm a matte paper guy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I hate glossy with every fiber of my being. I really, and when you print matte, you really have to know your stuff or else it just never comes out right.
So when you're printing your images that you take on film, are you scanning those and then printing them on the Epson?
For the most part nowadays, yes. When I shoot film, I'm also typically a color shooter. It's funny. If you look at my work over the past few years, almost all the color work is film and all the black and white work is digital. So it's kind of this odd, like everyone always expects the black and white stuff to be film and the color stuff to be digital. But I've kind of switched the balance because I much prefer the way daylight film kind of renders in just about any light.
Yeah. What film are you using?
I'm a big Portra 400 guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's my personal favorite. It's just the most kind of utilitarian. It's the most flexible. When I shoot black and white, I tend to go for either Fuji Acros 100 or Delta 3200. I really like those kind of flavors.
Mm-hmm.
I like having kind of these distinct choices. And yeah, and so I've always been kind of a – I don't mind grain. I don't mind some tooth as long as there's still detail. Like a lot of people – one of my favorite cameras to use is the M9, the digital M9. A lot of people say it's useless above 800. I totally disagree. I love the way that it handles when it gets grainy because it retains detail, it retains sharpness, but it does kind of an it has kind of an openness to the shadows that I really like.
No, I like the grain too. Maybe it's just because I'm old.
I'll never add grain. I have a lot of friends who are adding grain now. Uh-huh. That's not something I really like. It just doesn't look right to me. It looks digital. But I don't mind if I'm shooting something that already has, if I'm at ISO 3200, if I'm at, even on the Sony, I could do 25,600 and it had kind of an interesting flavor. I don't mind that kind of space and that kind of flavor.
So you say you shoot with a Leica, but you don't really own one?
Well, I own an M6.
Oh,
that's
okay.
The one that I use myself. I own an M6 with my favorite 40mm f2 lens.
Mm-hmm.
I have the Minolta Rokor branded Leica. So it's Leica glass in a Japanese housing, which brings down the price a little bit. But that's kind of my trade secret. That's my favorite lens to use because it gives me both. Like if I shoot a 35, I can only shoot horizontally. If I shoot a 50, I can really only shoot vertically. So this gives me kind of a nice balance between the two.
So what's on the horizon for you? What's in terms of projects? What's in your bucket list?
Well, I want to the joke is always the recreate the Americans, but that is something that I've always wanted to do as a long term project, traveling across the United States, and documenting. I always joked that it was the American Motel, but I think that's something that I'd really like to do. Maybe even in like a large, like 8x10, 4x5 format. But, one thing I've always found really important is creativity. And I come from this creative background. All of my friends are writers, actors, dancers, other photographers. And so the next big project down the pipes, I think, is going to be one based around young artists and people. I'm 20, I have these really incredible contemporaries, but also like the high school I went to is still a place that is very important to me, and there's a lot of really close friends in the teaching staff and even some that are still in students, and kind of a documentation of these young kids doing this work that they're very proud of. another piece that I've always wanted to do is embed myself in a Broadway show and shoot from the first auditions all the way through to the Tonys. That's something I've always wanted to do. And yeah, it's stuff that I just need that drop of access for. And at this point, I have 90% of what I need. I just need the time. So yeah, it's just building out these relationships and finding the time and really finding a way to do justice to the projects I want to do. For that, the traveling across the states when I really want to do it with like basically just four people in a car, me as a photographer, a filmmaker, a musician, and a writer, and create this project kind of with everything together. So it's really this creative balance and collaboration is something that is very, very important to me. So hopefully the next couple of projects have that sort of balance to them.
It seems like most people, they have, you know, they want to do a project, or they want to do a photo story, but they never quite get around to doing it, or they don't have the idea. I mean, what advice would you give somebody who's struggling with getting started?
First thing I would say is start small. Start with something that you have daily access to, be it the bus to work in the morning, be it the lunch counter, be it something that you can shoot day in, day out, and garner that access and garner that comfort from your subjects. If you're doing a street photography project, really make it visually different, because the issue is nowadays there's so much work out there that it's really hard to set yourself apart. For me, what I used to set myself apart is I did color, because there's not a lot of color street photography nowadays. And it's just – it's finding something that lets you play with your visual style and lets you really just get into something past just taking the pictures. Because what makes a project isn't just a visual consistency. It's a visual consistency that speaks to a larger thought. So write down that thought. Work on it. Develop it. It's just as important, if not more important, than the final photos. Concept can be everything. So yeah, just coming up with something and working at it day in, day out. Don't leave the house without your camera. I say that to every single person who walks through the door, like, as if you don't have the camera around your neck, you're doing something wrong. So it's really making it a tool that is reflexive to you, as well as a moment that allows you to capture it over and over and over and just have that flexibility.
Yeah, the point you make about access keeps coming back, and it reminds me of one of the episodes of The Candid Frame that Abarian X did with a guy he photographed in a juke joint down in, I think, Mississippi or Alabama. Uh-huh. I don't know if you saw that one or you saw
it. I have, yeah.
Fabulous work. And I guess this place is famous and like Hollywood celebrities would come in there with their cameras and shoot. But this guy had access to everything and he just did some phenomenal work.
No, yeah. It's that whole idea of finding something that not only you can photograph, but that allows you to photograph and allows you to create work that you can look at the end of the day or whenever you get your roles developed and feel very proud of it, and be able to show it to the people that you've been documenting and show and have them be proud of it. And it's finding that balance that is so hard, but is so worth it.
So how would you describe your style?
Yes,
good point. I guess we're all a work in progress, right?
Exactly. If you're not changing every day, then there's something wrong.
That's a very good point.
No, it's like for me, it's subject driven with a sense of scene. It's finding the balance where I'm not just, if I'm taking someone's portrait, it's not just of them. It shows their relationship to the world around them and to the instant that I'm documenting them in. Like, again, that's why, like, I will never buy another 50 millimeter. Because it doesn't give me the story. It's like when I take that kind of picture, I want to be able to tell a story.
Speaking of stories, what's your favorite story that somebody else has done, other than the Americans?
Ooh, that's hard.
I'm going to take that one off the table. Yeah, there is. But something we should go look at.
Ooh, I would probably say something by Mary Ellen Mark. She's one of my biggest influences, especially in just her approach to the kind of work she does. Scene Behind the Scene is one of my favorite series that she did, and that's 40 years worth of work of just her photographing behind the scenes on movies. Also, there's a bunch. She does really incredible work. Streetwise, I would actually have to say that's probably my favorite piece that she's ever done. And it's dark, it's gloomy, it's serious stuff. It's homeless street children in Seattle. And it's an incredible series that, again, shows access. And it shows that she shoots these kids day in, day out, to the point where they're so comfortable with her that you won't be able to believe some of the photos that she was able to get. It's jarring, it's dark, it's beautiful. But it's definitely worth, I would say, if you're only looking at one series and you really want to see how a series is best handled, Streetwise by Mary Ellen's definitely in my top five.
Oh, I'm going to look that up. So you spent your time between New York and L.A. I can't think of two different places to shoot. To shoot on the street. New York, walk out your door. I mean, you can't open your door without running into a good subject.
Exactly.
L.A.
You got to go hunting.
You do. And I've talked to a number of L.A. street photographers, and they all have the same issues. And what do you do? Where do you go? I mean, you drive downtown?
Downtown's definitely – that's a great spot to start. Personally, I don't find downtown particularly inspiring anymore. It may be because that's where every other L.A. street photographer is right now. But for me, Hollywood Boulevard is actually probably one of my defaults. I have a small office space on the corner of Hollywood and Cahuenga, up on the fourth floor of the old Hollywood building, where I can see from my window all the way down the boulevard, and I can see from my fire escape all the way down Sunset. So it's this really awesome space that gives me this kind of a base of operations, which is always nice. So I can photograph people on the street, and even if I find them interesting enough, like invite them up to the office where I can take a more formal portrait. But Hollywood Boulevard is always a default. I live in Studio City, which is this weird kind of like flux neighborhood between Hollywood and the rest of L.A. Technically, Studio City is the most central point of L.A. County. So everything is 45 minutes from it. but it's an interesting community because it's like all the movie studios are around there, but there's also like it's kind of bordering everything. So Studio City, Van Nuys. Van Nuys is a place that's near and dear to my heart and is just chock full of character. But I don't know anyone else shooting in Van Nuys, really. Yeah, it's just for me, it's choosing a location on a day and just getting out there and getting as much work done in the time that I'm there as possible.
Yeah, it helps to have weather you can walk around in too.
Yeah, and I like bad weather, honestly. Like I prefer cold, gloomy, overcast weather because A, it's easier to light.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm not a contrasty light guy. I'm not like I love Renzi with all my heart, but I can't understand how he gets that beautiful work done in that crazy, crazy downtown sharp light. I'm definitely a diffused open shadow kind of guy. I like my colors correct. I like my tones there. So,
well, come back to Cleveland, pay me a visit.
Sounds good.
We have lots of overcast.
I'm down with that.
So anyway, we got to start wrapping things up. Daniel, I wonder if you could tell us where we can find you.
You can find me on a couple of different places. Of course, Facebook. I'm under Daniel Sawyer Schaefer. I always like meeting new photographers, meeting other people doing good work. Please, if you can, drop me a line on there. Follow me on my kind of day-to-day blog where I post just kind of new stuff as it's shot at outlierimagery.tumblr.com. And then my portfolio website where there's stuff that's a little bit more organized is outlierimagery.com. You can also find me on Flickr. I don't use it as much as I used to. It's more of an archive than anything. But that's, again, flickr.com/outlierimagery. Just about any time you find Outlier Imagery, it's me. Feel free to drop me a line. If you're in Los Angeles, I work at Leica Store Los Angeles. Drop in, say hi. I'm always looking to meet new people. Bob, it was an absolute pleasure.
Hey, well, thank you. It was great. I'm glad we were able to get together, and we're going to
Yes, sir.
We're going to have to do this again.
Yes, sir.